I think today we're going to introduce ourselves. Last week, those who were not here, I did say welcome to the new year, and I wish everyone the best for 2015, and I'm still repeating for those who were not here, that all the best to all of you. I'm Priscilla Temba, the chairperson of the Select Committee on Labor and Public Enterprises, representing Mpumalanga in the National Council of Provinces. Members will introduce themselves and our guests, then we'll take it from there. Honorable Jacob.
Thanks, Chair, and good morning to everybody. I'm Priscilla Jacobs, representing the Free State in this Select Committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dirk Thorpman from Gauteng, member of the Select Committee. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Herman Groenewald, member of the committee and representing the Northwest Province.
Macelone. The name of Vijay Ruhani, the representative of the Limpopo province, the member of the committee, the Dova Hafun Davachime Vijay in a committee. Dolivo.
Dolivo. DDG.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable members. My name is Temba Piri. I'm a DDG for ICT Policy and Strategy in the Department of Communications.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members. My name is Alf Wolf, Director of Legal Services at the DOC.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Colin Dimakato Mashile, Chief Director of Broadcasting and E-Content Department of Communications.
Good morning. I'm Kayaletu Husha. I'm the senior administrative officer from the telecommunications telecommunication policy development.
Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Chair and members. I'm Ephraim Adam, Department of Communication, Regulatory Impact Assessment Director. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Herman Smuts. I'm from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members. My name is Mbilo Ngingo. I'm from ICASA. I'm the Acting General Manager, Legal and CCC. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Herata Mole, State Department of Communications, Legal Services.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Zolisa Kabadi. I'm a Parliamentary Liaison Officer, Ministry of Communications.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Inga Matagati. I'm from Ethical Political Consulting. I'm here as an observer.
Morning, Chairperson and members. My name is Denzel Bowman, and I'm from Neotel.
Morning, Honourable Chair and members. I'm Carmelita Donasadli, and I'm from Telkom.
Morning, Chair. I am. Morning, Chair and members. I am Dirk Winterbach from PMG.
Hi, good morning. I'm Zayton Anthony. I'm from the Bonaventure Office, Department of Communication.
Hello, I'm Naima Karim from the DG's Office in Cape Town.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Loli Sibisi, the Committee Secretary.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Aaron Foskati. I'm the Colin Advisor for the Committee.
Yeah. Lodin, can you close the door, please, and introduce yourself?
We've got apologies. The first one is from the Minister of Communications, Honorable Eunice Karim. Then the Deputy Minister, Honorable Dabini Abraham. Then we've got the other one from the DG. I've got written apologies. Written apologies from the Minister, from the Deputy Minister, from the DG. And we've got an apology from Honorable Sibande, who has gone to brief the province on ASDAS Section 76 legislation. Then we've got another apology from Honorable Dau, who is attending a presidium meeting. Some other members who didn't apologize will join us. Okay, and then we've got another apology from Barbara Lutz, who's our legal. He says she's from the legal services. Our agenda stands as follows. We will have deliberations on the Electronic Communications Amendment Bill. Bill B 17B of 2013, and followed by the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa Amendment Bill, Bill 18B of 2013. I'll give this opportunity to the department to actually again brief us, clarify us also on issues that were raised in the last meeting. We'll start. Can we start with the CASA? Mr. Mashine? After you have presented CASA to us, then we will go to electronic and then members will engage. Thanks. Over to you. The members to be informed and be on board of what is happening on this bill. So you can just go through quickly and then we'll take it from there.
Chair, may I please put the presentation up and I need to put it on the screen. Is it okay? I think from the committee side, the most important issue that was raised is the issue that the Honorable Chair raised around the one related to the contract of councillors, which has to be discussed in consultation with the National Assembly. I think, Chair, we agree with the point that the Chair had raised, that rather than write National Assembly there, it should change to Parliament. So that one, I think, Chair, it was raised by the members, and because it's clause 7 of the amendment to Section 6A, which had indicated that the evaluation of the performance of the chairperson or other councillors must be conducted by a panel constituted by the minister in consultation with the National Assembly. So we agree that we are going to write in consultation with Parliament. And honourable member had also raised the issue around the registered political party, and then we had indicated that in terms of the legislation, what we had done, we had deleted that because that was going to be so I will need to just upload this. The computer.
Chairperson, whilst Mr. Mashile is uploading the presentation, you had asked us to indicate to you what issues were raised by stakeholders. To that effect, the DG signed a letter to your office submitting those issues that came from stakeholders. When the chairperson allows, we can actually go through that after Mr. Mashile. Honourable Chair, thank you very much. These issues, Honourable Chair, emanates from the submissions by various organizations, and most of these concerns here have since been resolved during the deliberations by the PCC. I think first, Chair, it's important to outline around the ECA that the major objectives in this bill is to ensure an effective and efficient regulation to also make sure that there is more transparency in decision-making at ICASA. There is a foundation for better working relations between the Minister and ICASA Council, ICASA being an independent authority, which authority is derived from the elements around broadcasting in terms of the Constitution of the Republic. Also, the important issue is for the alignment of the ECA with the BBB Act of 2003, which act has gone through amendments. We have since consulted with the Department of Trade and Industry on the BBB Act and the sector codes. We are satisfied that the approach we are taking in these bills is consummate with the amendments in the BBB Act. There are minor issues which will affect the ICT sector code as it stands, and on that we will also be undertaking work to ensure alignment, particularly compliance with the legislation by this industry as a requirement, as an enforced requirement. Also, the intention of these bills was to refine the provisions that has to do with the licensing framework, to also ensure improvement in sections that relate to competition matters, to also clear regulatory bottlenecks which may be a hindrance to the growth of the sector, to also make sure that there are improvements on the E-rate provision. This E-rate provision is already in the legislation. We have extended the 50% E-rate to the public health facilities in addition to schools. Initially, this section only dealt with public schools. We have now opened this up for all schools in the country. Now, some of the issues, Honorable Chairperson, if I may just go through them. There was an issue about on Section 1B, which had to do with the allocation terminology. The allocation of radio frequency spectrum, as we know it, in this legislation, we found that there was an inconsistency. And in this regard, we have aligned this provision with the International Telecommunication Union's guidelines, such that the role of the minister and that of ICASA is clarified. The minister, in terms of the legislation, does have powers to make policy with relation to radio frequency spectrum. ICASA has authority to allocate frequency spectrum and therefore license. Another issue which was also raised by a number of stakeholders had to do with the definition of allocation. And the department's view with regards to this was that we do not have to change the section that already existed in Section 1C with regards to the definition of broadband, because the definition was proposed in a detailed study which will inform the new broadband policy. So you will also note, Chairperson, that in the legislation, as we presented last week, there is an intention to already deal with the urgent issue of broadband, which is a priority in the country. And in there, we have sections that deal with the broadband definition, which also has to be done. So the department, in that regard of Section 1C, maintained its definition of broadband. The issue around the common carrier, Chairperson, this is Section 1F. Originally, the CENTEC, the Broadcasting Act, define the common carrier to mean CENTEC. However, in the ECA, this definition was actually removed, and therefore causing a conflict as to who is the common carrier in the country. The importance of defining the common carrier to be specific is because in Section 62 and 67 of the legislation, there are obligations imposed on the entity which is referred to as the common carrier. Now, those obligations include a non-discriminatory access that must be given by this particular entity for broadcasting services. And we found that if we are not clear on this, this may interfere with the responsibilities of CENTEC to assist even broadcasters who may not necessarily have the financial muscle to pay for their services. So CENTEC, as it is declared in this definition as the common carrier, and therefore CENTEC carries the obligation of ensuring that it gives non-discriminatory access to anyone who requests its services. And this is actually a progressive definition in that CENTEC then plays its central role in providing signal distribution. Another issue, Chairperson, as I move forward, on Section G, relates to the electronic communication facilities. A number of companies here, including Neotel and Telkom, had wished that we remove all new definitions because of in relation to the passive infrastructure, and that we should add something called digital primary switching units and digital secondary switching units. We have discussed this section at length, and our response to this was that the amendment of the definition has been proposed by licensees and is aligned with international best practice, and where non-licensee control facilities are clearly marked, they won't be found. They won't be bound by the ECA. So, our intention was not to have an exhaustive list. I'll jump certain sections, chapter 10. I just want to go to the one that deals with radio frequency spectrum license. There was a concern here that we remove a reference to services because this is a license to use radio frequency spectrum and not provide services as such. In this case, Chairperson, we responded by indicating that the objective is to bring Chapter 5 licensees into the ambit of the definition of a licensee, and they're defined to mean a person issued with a license to provide services in terms of Chapter 3 or use the radio frequency spectrum in terms of Chapter 5, and this alignment was actually acceded to. I'll move quickly to other important issues, Chairperson, in the list. Of course, the list has been submitted to the committee. We've also aligned the issues around calendar days, Honourable Chairperson, and this was to give consistency to the legislation. So in this case, a calendar will be removed and will be replaced with days, as it is currently in the bill. One issue which tended to cause a confusion was the requirement that the minister must be provided with a copy of a draft regulation. This is section 4.5. Chairperson, we found that in instances where the minister has to account on the work or the whole portfolio of the Department of Communications, if a minister is provided with a copy of what regulations are being made and to what extent the regulations speaks to the policy directives that he may have issued, that is a very good practice, in fact. And so in other instances, this was seen to be encroaching on ICASA's domain. But previously, the minister has always had to be advised regarding a regulation. This is simply just to make sure that the minister has a copy of what is proposed. And with that, the proposed amendment does not empower the minister to approve or reject per se, but simply to be aware such that the minister can file. And if Parliament asks minister to account, minister is able to say that I know that ICASA is attending to 1, 2, 3, 4 issues in terms of its regulation. So this has been one issue that we have also clarified. Chair, I may as well see other issues here. I want to go into the provisions that deals with competition, because those were other major ones. Okay. So on broad-based black economic empowerment, Section 9, here, Chairperson, just to explain how we are doing the alignment. What we are simply saying is that this legislation had something that was making reference to historically disadvantaged individuals. And also, it was not necessarily clear that we are implementing the PPB Act, as it were. So the alignment we're doing is to ensure that we promote the triple BEE in Section 4.3K of the ICASA Act and to support the empowerment goals. This means that when ICASA is issuing licenses and the related spectrum, ICASA will take due regards to the triple BEE Act as the legislation that promotes empowerment, and that is how the section of Triple B Act is included in the whole legislation. So the alignment as such in section 9.2B is the reference to a minimum of 30% equity ownership that remains a minimum prerequisite for new individual licenses. Chairperson, let me just explain here a little bit. The sector codes have a number of points to allocate to entities. And this could be skills that may accrue to previously disadvantaged groups. It may also be points relating to procurement, which promotes black economic empowerment. But the reason why we are maintaining the 30% equity ownership is because this has always been one of the key elements of black economic empowerment. And so that 30% ownership is also aligned with the legislation. Regardless of the fact that the ICT sector code does not necessarily give this percentage, and we think that the percentage given in the ICT sector code is actually lower than this particular requirement of 30%, because it talks about a transaction which may be up to 7.5 billion. And when we look at the market capitalization of this sector, we think that this sector has grown far beyond those amounts, and hence we're talking about aligning that sector code. So we are strictly aligning to the legislation. Another section, Chairperson, which is important, I think I'll also rest here. It's the section 13, the transfer, ownership, and control of a license. Here the intention of the department is that when an entity wants to transfer a license, it must consult ICASA. There have been observations in the market that certain activities does happen wherein we observe that licenses have been sublet without the notification of ICASA, and this may be problematic for ICASA when it consolidate its books as to who is owing them of licenses and who hasn't paid and who exactly has the license at that point in time. So we think this is one of the sections that is closing an existing problem that had been there. Chairperson, other issues, like I have said last week, which are major policy issues, have been deferred to the ICT policy review. And the committee may have noted that the green paper in that process has now been put in the Gazette, so that discussion has begun. And these are issues relating to what we had proposed initially about the establishment of the compliance commission within ICASA as an independent structure. Those issues have been left out. The establishment of the spectrum management agency as enjoined by the white paper on broadcasting, that issue has been left for a broader policy discussion in the white paper process. The issues around the structure of ICASA, whether ICASA must be reduced to a membership of 5 councillors or whether they must be full-time. All of those issues have been taken out of the bill because they are dealt with in the other legislation. Chairperson, in the nutshell, this is the summary of what we have dealt with as we come along with this particular bill, 2 bills.
Okay, thank you, GGG. Can we now hear from Mr. Masile?
So, sorry for the delay, Chairperson and honorable members. I'll start. In relation to the purpose of the ECA, what the intention was to amend the ICASA Act of 2000 so as to insert new and amend existing or repeal obsolete definition. Also to provide further clarity on the powers and duties of the authority and to introduce mechanisms to ensure the accountability of the authority, including that of councillors and committees of council, and to confirm the use of electronic communications networks and services for the purposes of electronic transactions and to provide matters connected therewith. In terms of clause 1, honorable members, the issue that arose there was around the concurrent jurisdiction agreement. As indicated, ICASA for now has only one concurrent jurisdiction agreement with the Competition Commission because that is in law. And subsequent to that, the Consumer Commission came up, Films and Publications Board is dealing with matters that ICASA also deal with. So we are trying to allow a situation where it will not only be the Competition Commission, but ICASA can also deal with other similar bodies to ensure that the sector is regulated properly. Also, in relation to days, as explained earlier on, the way the days were defined had increased the turnaround time for ICASA. So we were trying to ensure that ICASA is efficient and respond quickly to matters that they might be faced with. And also we were trying to reflect that the Telecommunications Act was repealed. So, and also to ensure that everything is in line with the correct name of the ECA. And ICASA as a public institution, when they make decisions, everyone has the right to challenge them in court if they are not happy, whether it's decisions taken at the CCC or by the Council of ICASA. So close to, in relation to amendment of Section 3, was trying to achieve that. In relation to Clause 3, which is to Section 4, the most important one is around 7E, that although Section 74 provides for limited sanction in certain respects, and Section 17A to 17E of the ICASA Act currently deals with the powers of the CCC in relation to disputes and complaints, there's no specific power given to ICASA to determine penalties and sanctions, and as this, and the case may be in the principal act, even under regulation. So the bill seeks to remedy this situation by proposing a new power for ICASA in paragraph P of subsection 3. Around the CCC, honorable members, there has been debate to say ICASA, because CCC makes the recommendation to the council. So the complaint was that ICASA plays the referee, the player, and everything. So what should happen to the CCC as a body that has to adjudicate independently of ICASA? So we were trying to also address that. And also to ensure that ICASA is guided by the principles of administrative justice. And as we can recollect, in 2007, from January 1, ICASA has been given the mandate of the postal services. So we wanted also to reflect the function of ICASA in relation to postal. I think South Africa was one of the first leading countries to do that. If you check in various countries, you don't have one regulator. You have, because of how they are structured, you'll have telecoms and broadcasting in one area, and then because of cultural issues, you'll find broadcasting in another one. So in terms of what we did as a country, I think we were one of the leading nations to foresee convergence and ensure that all these sectors that are related are regulated under one roof. This one has been explained of clause 3A. And in relation to this one, I think the most important point was around bullet point number 3, which says this clause also deals with the powers of delegation of the council. In this regard, the general powers of ICASA in relation to decisions about licensing are critically important and may not be delegated to a councillor or committee of council or committee of ICASA. I think here, as we had said in terms of our purpose, we are trying to ensure that we clarify that there are certain matters that the authority or the council of ICASA cannot delegate to a committee, because licensing is a core function of ICASA, and decisions that are supposed to be taken are supposed to be the collective of council. So licensing cannot be delegated to any other body or to any other individual. It's a collective of the 9 councillors. In relation to clause 4 and 5, amendment to section B and 4B on 4C of the Act, here we are trying to, as indicated in relation to the definition of days, we are trying to shorten the time period within which inquiries may be held, because if ICASA has to engage in an inquiry, the minimum that it can take is 45 days as per the law. But the 45 days, when you see it in practice, it extends to about 60, or it can even go to 60 days or 90 days for that matter. So what we're trying to do was to correct this situation to ensure that inquiries do not take a lot of time, whereas you find that the industry or the public continues to suffer while this matter is taking a lot of time. So we were trying to increase the efficiency of ICASA. In relation to clause 6, amendment to section 5 of the Act, this also was the issue that members had written around the had raised around the expertise. And we were saying that when ICASA, at that point, the Act was passed in 2000, the required skills were as they were previously, but because of convergence and new issues coming, you also need to update the skills of the matters that ICASA has to deal with as the digital broadcasting environment emerge, as issues of internet emerge, as other issues related to telecoms and postal image. You need to update your skill set for the decision makers. So this is what we're trying to do by ensuring that we update the skill set that was required for anyone to be nominated as a councillor, but also to clarify that this does not exclude anyone, whether the member. I think the only people that are excluded is those that are holding political office at that point. But if you are a member of parliament and then you are no longer a member, your expertise can benefit ICASA, I think you will qualify. So no one is excluded except those that have been acknowledged by the law that if you hold office, you cannot do that. In relation to clause 7, amendment to section 6A, I think this is the one that one was explaining earlier on. This has to do with the performance management of ICASA, that you cannot judge one councillor over the other. What you do is collective performance management system. So a very important point was brought to us to say it should be in consultation with the National Assembly. It's a valid point, and then this is what we are going to change, that it is going to be in consultation with Parliament. And then the performance management system must be developed in consultation with Parliament, which will include both houses. So that is a very valid point, and then we take it, member. I think it will also assist ICASA in getting the comments from the representatives of our community. And clause 8, amendment to section 7 of the Act, this issue was also raised by members. The issue, honorable members, is that in terms of this sort of expertise bodies, members are usually, that serve in regulator, they usually serve for 2 terms. So we were trying to clarify that. It's only the chairperson that serves for 5 terms, for 5 years in terms of the service, so that there is a good handover when the others are coming. So it cascades in that way. So we were trying to clarify that issue as well. And that councillors are supposed to serve full-time, and if they are involved in other matters, just like any other member of any public body, there should be record of such, and they should inform in writing, and it should be recorded in terms of the work that they do. But it is assumed that on a daily basis, they will be at ICAS. And also there was some matters related to Clause 9, Amendment to Section 11 of the Act. The question that came up was around when would a council not have a quorum most of the time. Most of the time, I think it happens when members are on study tours or when others are on leave, and it becomes that you find that they are not forming a quorum. But on a normal basis, the authority usually, the council usually forms that quorum, which is 4+1. And I think we're also trying to acknowledge that, remember the councillors were 7, they increased to 9, so the increase has also given rise to where there was going to be difficulties, especially around decision-making processes. Also, the chief executive of ICASA may attend any council meeting in terms of the new proposed section, although he or she has no voting right. The reason why they do not have voting rights is that Parliament appointed the 9 to make decisions on behalf of ICASA. So what we are saying is that since the CEO is the accounting officer and he has to implement, I think it's normal course that they become part of those meetings even if they do not have voting rights, because the ones that are acknowledged by the law to have the voting rights is the ones that were the 9 that are appointed by Parliament. And we also clarify that the CEO is the accounting officer of ICASA in terms of PFMA, and then that the reason why he should attend is that he needs to be aware of all the issues and bring council into line with the budget that has been provided to ICASA. In terms of amendment of Section 11A, in terms of transparency, we are trying to indicate that the council's meeting minutes must be published. Everyone should be knowing. If you check, honorable members, if you go to Parliament, the minutes of this committee is published and the minutes of various other public institutions. So we're saying that they should be open around that issue, and that people should not use confidentiality to disadvantage ICASA from making the decision or to disadvantage the public from knowing certain matters. But the law previously had clarified that the council of the authority has the ultimate right to decide when an information can be declared confidential. Everyone that submits to ICASA can request for confidentiality, but the decision has to be taken by the collective of council whether they will clarify such information. And the question was raised that, like, when would information be confidential? For example, when you find that people apply for a license, they have their ICASA supposed to be aware of their commercial strategies and financial information that they cannot disclose because it might advantage their competitor. So they will request for such, and it's a normal practice within regulatory environment to provide such. And probably when also ICASA publishes certain reports and information is confidential, they usually black it out. So it's a normal practice that is usually engaged in. And the other issue that came, I think, was on page 26. This is the correct slide. The members had raised an important issue to say why was the slide that I presented different. I think it was my mistake, honorable members, which I apologize for. You had the correct document in terms of the it's only two paragraphs, unlike the others that were included. I think that was the first draft that we were doing. So this, which you had last week, you are correct to raise it. It's a correct document. I apologize for that. And I think that will be all from the ICASA.
Thank you very much, Mr. Masile. Can we go to members will engage after the electronic communication amendment? Can we ask Alf to lead us briefly? Just to bring other members who were not here on board. Can you switch your mic off, Mr. Masile?
Thank you, Honourable Chair and members. Let me try to take you through the Electronic Communications Amendment Bill. So a number of definitions are either inserted or amended. These are Advertising Standards Authority of South Africa, Allocation and Assignment, Broadcasting Service Radio Frequency Bands, defining broad-based black economic empowerment, broadband, definition for CEO, common carrier change to include to specifically refer to CENTEC, electronic communications facility, end user, ICT charter, and ITU, as well as licensee, political party, radio frequency plan, radio frequency spectrum, broadcasting service, a new definition for service license. The definition of universal service is amended to include electronic communications network services. Those are the definition amendments and insertions. Section 2H of the Act is amended to replace the phrase historically disadvantaged individuals with broad-based black economic empowerment. In Section 3, amendments are being made to ensure that the Minister can give policy guidelines to ICASA on spectrum fees. Section 3.2 is amended to enable the Minister to issue policy directions to USASA. It further seeks to broaden the scope of policy directions that may be issued by the Minister, really to enable the Minister to perform her responsibilities or her responsibilities more effectively. An amendment of subsection 5 confirms that policy should follow the same public consultation process as policy directions. Amendment of Section 4 proposes that the Minister be given a copy of the regulations, as the DDG alluded to. Clause 5, the reference again to the historical managed liberalization policies in subsection 6 is deleted, as it is now irrelevant. Clause 6 is an amendment of Section 8 and seeks to authorize the imposition of additional license terms and conditions on designated licensees relating specifically to universal access and universal service. The amendment of Section 9 seeks to link the equity ownership requirement with ICASA's powers to prescribe regulations on broad-based black economic empowerment in the ICASA Act, which is an alignment of the two. The amendment of Section 10 seeks to enable ICASA to amend a license in accordance with Chapter 10 Clause 9 seeks to ensure that the transfer, letting and subletting of individual licenses, including the transfer of control of such licenses, requires the prior approval of ICASA and that public consultation is performed. The changes in Clause 10 provide that class licenses obtained by any person may not collectively assume the scope or coverage of an individual license. Honourable Chair, Clause 11 seeks to simplify the class license registration process and turnaround time and includes consequential amendments following the amendment of Section 16. Clauses 12 and 13 amend Sections 20 and 21 of the Act, and the changes to Sections 20 and 21 seek to replace guidelines with policy and policy directions made by the Minister to remove the uncertainty on the status of the guidelines. Here referring to the rapid deployment of electronic communications guidelines that have now become policy and policy directions issued by the Minister. Section 20 sub 3 is new and seeks to require ICASA to prescribe how licensees must exercise their rights and fulfill their obligations under that chapter. Clause 15 to 16 contain amendments to Section 30 that seeks to align the radio frequency spectrum issues in Chapter 5 of the Act with the National Radio Frequency Spectrum Policy. It's here that those words, assignment, allocation, and licensing, and so on, are clarified. Section 31 is amended to require that a radio frequency spectrum license may not be assigned, ceded, or in any way transferred, and the control of a radio frequency spectrum license may not be assigned, ceded, or in any other way transferred to any other person without the prior written permission of ICASA. Amendments to Section 34.1 are made to ensure the Minister also addresses the coordination and approval of any regional radio frequency plans that apply in the Republic. Amendment of Sections 37 to 38. These seek to redefine the reasonableness of interconnection requests by changing the requirement for financial feasibility to economic feasibility. The changes further seek to ensure that interconnection agreements are not in any way discriminatory compared to comparable network services provided by a licensee to itself or an affiliate. Whereas these amendments apply to interconnection, similar amendments are made in the context of facilities leasing. The amendment of Sections 42 to 45 seek to nullify exclusivity provisions contained in any agreement or other arrangement that are prohibited under subsection 43.10 of the Act 1 year after the commencement of this particular Act. In Section 55, the bill seeks an amendment to ensure that ICASA may regulate scheduling of adverts, infomercials, and program sponsorships. This is a power ICASA previously had that is reinserted, as also proposed by ICASA. The amendment of Section 62 addresses the obligations of a common carrier and provides that it is deemed an electronic communications network service licensee that provides signal distribution for public broadcasting. Section 67 of the Act is the competition section. This clause seeks to delete subsections 1 to 3 to ensure a clear demarcation between ex ante regulation, being the preserve of ICASA, and ex post regulation that belongs with the Competition Commission. This is one matter that there is agreement on in the sector. Amendments to subsections 4 to 7 are intended to assist ICASA in implementing the regulatory regime set out in Chapter 10. Effectively, we're trying to simplify the whole Chapter 10 so it's easier to understand and implement. The amendment of Section 70 is necessary because we wish to make sure that this law is aligned with the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And consequently, wherever the word people with disabilities are used, we change it to persons with disabilities in line with the convention. Section 72 is being amended to ensure that the public can access government directory information and related services free of charge. a new Section 72 has been inserted to empower the Minister to establish the National Broadband Council in accordance with the promulgated broadband policy to advise the Minister on broadband policy and implementation. It is proposed that Section 73 be amended to assist with the enforcement of the E-rate provisions and to include public health establishments. The proposed Section 79A, Honourable Chair, seeks to ensure that the state and persons employed at 112 emergency centres do not attract liability when performing an act in good faith and in accordance with the provisions of the law. A new Section 79B is proposed, which seeks to enable the Minister to request information from relevant stakeholders, including ICASA, USASA, and the public, to enable the Minister to perform the responsibilities that the Minister carry. The amendment of Section 80 seeks to improve the governance of the USASA board and lists a whole range of its fiduciary duties in line with best practice and governance protocols. The amendment of Section 82 seeks to remove contradictions between that section and the definitions of universal access and universal service in the definitions section. Sections 82A to 82E are new provisions that are aimed at improving governance provisions in relation to the CEO of USASA. Clause 41 is an amendment of Section 88 of the ECA and seeks to empower the Minister, acting with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, to prescribe additional uses of money in the Universal Service and Access Fund from time to time. The clause furthermore seeks to require USASA to create, at least every 2 years, application procedures for persons to apply for subsidies from the Universal Service and Access Fund. This is really an enabling clause to assist USASA and to assist access to the subsidies in the fund. It also seeks to change ICASA's obligation to review the definition of underserviced area every 2 years instead of biannually, which is just a more practical arrangement. This clause, referring to clause 42, seeks to ensure that community broadcasting service licensees are exempt from contributions to the Universal Service and Access Fund as part of the intention and purpose to strengthen the community broadcasting sector. Lastly, Chair, clause 45 is an amendment to a consequential amendment to the Broadcasting Act, just to bring the definition of common carrier in that act in line with the definition in this ECA. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, honourable members. We have been listening to the okay. Before that, Mr. Perry, DGG.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to make it clear to the committee a very important section around Chapter 10. When we make reference to Chapter 10, it is the chapter that deals with competition matters. So in terms of this chapter, there is a procedure outlined there. If, for instance, ICASA is conducting an inquiry to determine whether there is a market dominance by one organization or one service provider, it follows that that particular chapter. We have found that maintaining this chapter as it is And with the litigious processes that ICASA is normally going through, and yet some of the matters ICASA can make a quick inquiry, make decisions about those matters, and institute regulations. So when we say that in Section 67, we are simplifying for ICASA to implement a regulatory regime that is set out in Chapter 10, we merely mean that ICASA need not always to be bound by that chapter when it has to make an observation on certain matters, but rather to on matters that are very clear, that are at face value, and where in ICASA can act, it is given that power to actually act. This competition chapter is observed to be a very complex and a lengthy process that normally ICASA has to go through. So as we deal with issues around liberalizing the market, reducing cost to communicate, and all of these urgent issues that are priority policies for the country, this section was found to be very important, that it must be addressed. I wanted to just explain that, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, honourable members. Can we now engage with the department on the two bills that have been presented and clarified to us, honourable Jacobs, followed by honourable Kuna?
Yeah, thanks, Chair, and also thank the department for the two presentations that they've made. I'll start one with the ICASA. On page 5-6 of the bill. Check. You know, I just want clarity on this issue of consultation with the National Assembly, whereby we requested that it should be Parliament. I just want to check whether are we not encroaching in the powers of the other House, to say maybe the Constitution gives them the powers to deal with such matters. Because I was thinking about this issue of ACBC. Normally, it is the National Assembly which approves the members of the Board of Directors and so on. As NCOP, normally they don't bring that to us. And like today, who's that, McBrown? Is it McBride? The National Assembly is going to adopt his appointment. So I just want to check on that. Maybe, as we are saying here, consultation should be done with the National Assembly. Because I think somewhere also there was where a reference was made to the National Assembly. I think there's somewhere, I just not checked on that one. The other one on page 7, amended section 11 of 13, their intent, they say the quorum for any meeting of the council is the majority of councillors in the office at that time. What does it mean? Does it mean people who are around, or the people who will be there during their term of service? If we can just get clarity on that one also. On page 8,
just check 14. Yeah. Clause 20 there. Such other stuff as the council may deem necessary. I want to check there, is that stuff temporary stuff or is it an additional? Just like in 35, clause 35 there. We are talking also about to appoint as many experts as may be necessary. So are those appointments temporary or they are additional? And now, amendment of section 15 of the Act 13 of 20, there, that five checks drawn by the authority must be regarded have been duly assigned. I want to have clarity. Who actually signs these checks? Because, say, and another member of the staff or a councillor. Can we get clarity? Because the issue of signing checks is very sensitive. It cannot be given to any other person. Page 9. On 19, the annual plan. We are talking that by the submission of an annual plan. Does it go hand in hand with what is it? With the financial plan, or is it just an annual plan? Because I think annual plan must be supported by a financial plan. I think the last one that I want to, on page 12, here you, for offenses, you are stipulating penalties. It was 250,000, now it's 5,000. Are we not doing something that it has to be done by the court of law? To say it should not exceed 5 million. Are we channeling the magistrate or even the judges to come to this amount? Because maybe we are encroaching in their independence. So I just want to get that clarity. I think that's about all.
Thank you, Honorable Jacobs. Honorable Cronenberg.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation as well. With the second bill, I agree. I haven't got any problem with the second one. But the first one of the ICASA, there's only some clarification I want to be on page 4 of the bill. And that is 4H. It's in the middle of the. If you can just clarify that whole paragraph for me, 3A, when you started with 3A, the authority. If you can clarify that. The reason why I'm asking the chairperson is that the view I've got here is that it is undermining the independence of ICASA. So if you can, that's why I want more clarification on this whole issue. And if we are looking into the independence as set out in section 192 of the constitution. So if we are looking into that with the clause there, if you can just give us that. Thank you very much. That's all.
Thank you. We'll start with Ikas. Mr. Mashile, how about you?
Honorable Jacobs, you don't mind if I start with the one on page 4 so that I move across the pages. Yes. Honorable Khurenobal, on chapter 4, I think you are raising a very important point that has been a discussion throughout the bill. And to protect the independence of ICASA, this has been a very important debate. What it says there is that it must consider the policy made or the policy direction by the minister in terms of this act. If you check in various regulations and institutions and law, in between the policy making process, it is assumed that when you pass your law, it usually stands for about 3 to 5 years. So in between, when new issues will come, the minister will issue out the policy directive to ICASA to consider. And that's how the department drafts its policy directives. What it usually does is that before the policy directive is published, the minister consults with ICASA to say, I intend to publish this policy directive. Then what the minister does after consulting with ICASA, he or she publishes it in the public domain to say, this is the policy directive that I intend issuing out to ICASA. Is it legal? Is it not against the section of the Constitution that you have highlighted? It's a very important point, and the way we have drafted it was not to be in conflict with that section of Section 192 of the Constitution. I don't know if you'll take my word for it, but I reassure you, look at my face, I reassure you, it's safe, you are safe. You are safe. We have not diluted or undermined the powers that have been afforded to ICASA by that section of the Constitution. So that's why the minister has to consult with ICASA before he does that. So I think it's a normal administrative justice procedure. So we have not interfered with its independence. Thank you for in relation to the National Assembly, I think my DDG will have to.
On page 5 and page 6.
Chairperson, this issue of the powers of the two houses is very important, and we have been thinking about it. I think similar to the observation that Honorable Jacobs is making, we may want to ask the state law advisor to give us an opinion on it in terms of the Constitution of the Republic. So I'll ask Mr. Smith, who is in the House, Honorable Chair, through you, if you'll allow that he give us a take on the matter.
Chairperson, yes, actually my colleague is also here to assist, but let me try to answer this. Section 55 of the Constitution vests the power of oversight on the National Assembly. But so it is first and foremost the NA who exercises oversight. But in my view, nothing prevents Parliament to come in and a new bill and say that to give the power as contemplated in the bill to Parliament and not only to the National Assembly. So it wouldn't be, in my view, unconstitutional if the bill is amended or proposed to be amended by changing National Assembly to Parliament.
Chair, just to concur, Mr. Smith is correct with that view. What I want to emphasize, Chairperson, is that we read legislation and constitution in total as a whole. Not that we don't concentrate on the particular section. So, for instance, if you read that section that deals with the independence of ICASA, and it tells you where ICASA is accountable to, which house ICASA is accountable to, and that house, in terms of the constitution, is the National Assembly. So it is in the scheme of that, and the scheme of the whole Act, not only the sections that are being amended. There are other sections within the Act which only refers to Parliament. So it is in that scheme of the legislation that then this National Assembly is maintained, because at the end of the day, ICASA reports to only the National Assembly in terms of the Constitution. One may appreciate that opinion and say, no, the Constitution talks about the independent broadcasting, you know, regulator, but ICASA deals not only with the broadcasting services, it deals also with other services, not only that, but like telecommunications and other things. Then, could you say the bill extended the scope of what is envisaged in the Constitution? Then it makes sense for this body to report not only to the National Assembly but also to the other House as well, which the issue that Mr. Smart has raised comes now in, because the scope of the body that was envisaged in the Constitution was extended. Now it makes sense for other House. But as the bill, not only the bill, as the Act now stands, the Act makes ICASA accountable to the National Assembly. So it will mean now we'll have to go back to the whole bill process when, for instance, in future the Act now is reviewed, for instance, then that issue can be taken up, because there are other sections of the Act which are not the subject of this amendment bill, which refers to the National Assembly. Then that would create a mismatch if now we say that it's Parliament, we go to Parliament and not the National Assembly. So for now, it makes sense that we must retain Parliament, and maybe in future when the Act is reviewed, then that issue can be taken up. That's one issue. The other issue is one that Mr. Mashile has responded. Mr. Mashile has responded that I want to also emphasize what Mr. Mashile, in terms of the Honorable Member there. Also with that, for instance, in the Act itself, it is there where the Minister must make those policy directions and policies. The Minister makes those. And the thing is this, although ICASA is independent, by virtue of that section of the Constitution, Section 92, but at the end of the day, policy making is the purview of the executive by virtue of Section 85(2) of the Constitution. So the Minister is responsible for making policy with regard to communication and other issues, which is the function of ICASA. Then it makes sense that the ICASA, even though it's independent, but that independence is relative. Is relative to the powers and also the functional independence of the executive. So it makes sense that at least you must consider those policy directions that are made by the most, because it's made those policies relative to communication, which is the subject of ICASA. So what I'm saying is that we read all these issues in the whole. We don't just focus on those sections. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Are we finished? Because I want to get back. It's a follow-up question. Yes. You've said it now, and you said I can look you into the eyes. That's why I'm asking a follow-up question, because I'm worried at the end of the day that the minister can overrule the executive when decision-making is come. How are the executive protected against the minister's will at the end of the day? So I'm a bit worried about that, because that the executive must have the say, as you said now.
Sorry? Cabinet.
Yeah, but if we're talking about ICASA, then they haven't got any say at the end of the day. If the decision is made by the cabinet, And I don't think that is the way we want to go.
See? Then followed by
Chairperson, I was just taking advice here from Mr. Alfred.
No, Chairperson, we are not necessarily doing a major change here. In fact, the spirit of the law expects that ICASA must act like my colleague there is saying, must act within the ambit of the policy environment. Mm-hmm. So it is not as decisions ordinarily. We are talking about issuing a policy or a policy direction, which minister is empowered in terms of Section 3 to do so on certain matters. Now, ICASA, because the independence of ICASA is independence of decision-making about how it licenses, how it collects, how it does that. So, this section does not conflict with that independence, because when the minister starts to make policy, and as a norm, we consult ICASA, who makes input into the policy that the minister is going to issue to them. We also consult the public in that same way. Now, they must consider how it is already existing in the legislation. We are not making any changes to that. So, in the consideration that ICASA makes, ICASA often issues a memorandum of how it has considered the directive that the minister has issued. And within that, ICASA also has independence in making decisions about to what extent can it move on that issue. Because, as you know, a minister issues a directive so that ICASA can promulgate regulations. So there is no devil contained in minister's directive which can be cured by ICASA refusing to understand the ambit within which the policy is issued. Because policy is issued in context. And when the minister consults ICASA, ICASA makes an input, which we as a department consider. So we meet as officials and discuss it in detail, and then we issue it. So there shouldn't exist, Chairperson, a element of doubt about the intentions of the policymaker and how the regulator, ICASA, issues is, because when ICASA is doing its work, also is going to conduct public consultations, is going to have experts doing this. So I think the, if you look at the section now, that must consider has always been there. It might be problematic if we are amending this section to say must implement, which we have thought about, and it will not be correct in the spirit of the Constitution as it relates to broadcasting matters, that we say ICASA must implement minister. That may amount to just taking the word of the minister and then run with it. But here there's a test that ICASA runs in terms of this section that as it exists now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Khrunova.
Thank you, Chairperson. The public hearings you're talking about, where is it fit in the process now? Is it after the minister and make an announcement of changing, or is it where? Because I feel the minister can make his or her input on that public hearing.
No, the minister, when he makes policy and policy directives, he also takes into account the inputs made by the public in the policy. Now, subsequent to that, the policy is then issued to ICASA to do certain things. When ICASA considers that policy directive, ICASA also goes on a public consultation again to promulgate a regulation. And this is the process that goes. Thank you.
Yeah, just to assist in the debate and to put the concerned member of parliament at ease, I think it is appropriate to go to the original proposal that was made by the policymaker, that is DOC, which was followed by a very contentious discussion, because they were trying to take away that power from us. They wanted us to implement. It was whether we must implement. And then we said, no, we can't agree to that. We have to consider each and every policy that comes our way, which must be implemented by us. We finally, therefore, agreed with them that the word may should be retained, so that we are given an opportunity to consider those policies. Because if I can give an example of one policy that was issued by the minister, it was a policy on Pusanos. It goes way back to 2007-08, where we advised the minister that the ECA does not make provision for Pusanos, and we advised her to abandon that policy, and she agreed with us, and then it was abandoned. So we are happy with the contents of the bill as they are at the moment. Thank you.
Mr. Mashile, can you continue, please, with your responses?
Honorable Jacobs, I'm going to page 7 around the issue of the Quora. We need to locate that to that one of 5 years and 4 years, and that in between the years you'll find that the members, others resign, others their term will end. I think it relates to the number of councillors at that point that are serving the term during that point. You might find that, for example, you had a situation where two or three, their term had ended, and you find that there are 7 councillors. So the majority of council at that point will change as their term expires, as some resign. So it's those that are appointed to serve at that point. During that time, that will form a quorum. That are legitimately councillors at the day at which the decision is supposed to be taken.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. But now, what about the person who's not in this house? Will he take it the way as he is explaining? Because I think it must be clarified to anybody who is reading the act.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Let's see if we can take it a bit further. So if it says the majority of councillors in office at the time, firstly, councillors in office would mean if out of the 9, 5 of the councillors are appointed. Those are the councillors in office. It excludes the vacancies, in other words, at that point in time. So you have the 5. It adds to that the chairperson now, so that no one, for certainty, that's the actual amendment. So it's that 5 plus the chairperson, making it 6. Then it says the majority of that 6 is the quorum, which means it is 3 plus 1 would be the majority. So if 3 plus 1 is in the meeting, that would be the quorum for the meeting.
Yeah, thanks. I understand what you're saying. But that it leads to anybody's interpretation. To me, it is not clear here unless you make that clarity. And then what I'm saying, what about any person who comes across this act, who's not here? Will he or she have the same understanding that I have now through the explanation that they have made?
How are you going to make it, you know, clear to the society, to the people who are not part and parcel of this meeting?
Chairperson, that's a difficult question to answer. I can only say with respect that this is ordinarily the way it's written into laws, and the people that are really exercising this power and live in accordance with this provision are really the councillors themselves. So the most important thing to me personally would be that the councillors understand the meaning in the section. If there's a way to draft it better, certainly we are all here obliged to make sure that it is drafted better. It has gone through a process with the best drafters through the state law advisors and others that have contributed to this process. So I want to believe that from a legal perspective it's good drafting. For the rest, I have to say that this is, as I said, ordinarily the way it's written into laws. Not sure if I can take it further. Thank you, Chair.
State law advisor. Advisors. All of you. Can you assist us, please? Because we want to let something go through that also other people will understand. Who's that is?
Yes, I can just emphasize or repeat what Mr. Walsh said, and that is that this expression occurs in many laws, but that does not solve the member's concern. One can perhaps work with... And we must remember that these words have been in the Act since 2000. It's not
so we are now changing, you know, amending. So we want, you know, we are from the rural areas. We represent the interest of the rural people, let me say, put it that way. So we want, when the law goes past us, that the ordinary person will understand the law that we have passed. So 2000, it was that time. That time, like last week I said, 2000, we argued that national, why only National Assembly? So this is now the fourth parliament of the democratic, you know. So can you assist us so that we are also able to assist the people? Over to you.
Yes, we can... we can look at it. If the committee could give us time, we can propose new wording. For instance, binding decisions of the council are taken by a majority, something like that, or the minimum requirement for any meeting is the majority of the people of the. My colleague, it's actually he did the ICASA bill.
He's passing the button.
No.
Chaplain, as Mr. Wills has put it, this is how, and Mr. Smart has put it, this is how in legislation the provision is normally put. But Chaplain, as Chaplain will know that the Act always allow regulations, charter, protocol, and everything to be made out of the Act. And in most of the cases, those are made to simplify the Act, because most of the time the Act is written on a certain way. So, for instance, the operations of the council is what the operation of the council or say council or ICASA itself is one of those issues that are provided for in terms of regulations. So this issue now that the Honourable Momba, for instance, have raised, I'm sure Mr. From ICASA here is listening. So we will put it maybe in the language when the regulations are put in terms of that can be put, taking into account the concerns, for instance, that will be raised here. It can be simplified for members because that will be covered in the regulations.
I want to agree with Mr. Smart. I think let's follow that. Actually, by we sit down, we check what the country come with
a better wording, which might be understood by everyone. Like, I understand what is and Wuko says, but let's find out whether in this new era can be for a coming with that is easily understandable.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That they need to read draft because what he is saying, there is nothing he says it will be under regulation here. That is his own interpretation. So I would be comfortable with what he's saying.
And we must also, you know, adopt past something that we also understand, right? Mr. Mashile, over to you. You can continue.
Will you give us time to
yeah,
fine. We take note, Jeff.
Honorable Jacobs, in relation to the question of temporary or additional or on page 8 in relation to section 14B, if you check the original act, it talks about the staff of the authority. And then at the authority, at times you'll have temporary staff, at times you'll have those that are additional. But I think it was dealing with the staff that will assist the council to perform its regulatory making functions. But at times you'll have them as full-time, at times you'll have them as part-time. I don't know. And in relation to the next one, around the expert, I think that one was in relation to appointment of experts, which would basically be your sort of where you commission people outside of ICASA to come and do the work for you in relation to section 14A.
When the honourable member wants to say something, he'll raise his hand.
I did give the honourable record a hint on this issue. Can I just also clarify that the issue of mandating council to establish such staff components relates to the fact that it may be that the organization is expanding. It is observing that in terms of this legislation, even this amendment, there is a need to expand the structure itself. And so it is given powers to do that in order to help it do its function. Chair, the issue of the checks as contained in 18, section 15.4, and the question is who handles the checks at ICASA. The provision that we have here, which was in existence, was to ensure the balance between the staff members of ICASA, could it be the CFO, the CEO, as well as the executive council at ICASA, such that those bodies are given the authority to sign the checks. And these are designated people by council, and that's what we are indicating there. You see, Chairperson, at some point there was a confusion about the functions of the CEO, which has an impact on how the organization functions, as well as that of ICASA, because the temporary restructuring that took place at ICASA was actually a worrisome trend. And It was not clear to us where does accountability of these decisions and their implementation ends. And we observed that it may ordinarily be causing a risk on the financial accountability of matters, because clearly in our minds the CEO and his administrative arm, which includes financial accountability, was seemingly left out. Yet the decisions that the Executive Council of ICASA makes have to be accounted for by the CEO, who also functions together with the CFO. So this is the nature of the of the amendment that we're dealing with after.
Thank you, Chair. The next one we wish to discuss is the Section 15A requirement of the annual plan, and does it go with the financial plan. So effectively, this annual plan, it really requires ICASA to prepare that plan for the year ahead at least once per year, and to provide this to the appropriate authorities. This will really enable more accurate forecasting of funding requirements and better planning and liaison with the, you know, with Treasury and the Department on the financial issues as well. Furthermore, it ensures and enables more transparency and certainty in relation to stakeholders. In short, Chairperson, Honourable Member, the budget will reflect how the annual plan will be executed in financial terms. So the budget is therefore really a component of the annual plan as well. Thank you.
Honourable Jacob.
Yeah, Chair. I just want to go back to that issue of signing of checks. Because here this is an accounting officer, another member of staff, or a council. Why do you pinpoint another member of staff? Because you could say the accounting officer, CFO, maybe, and the council. Why specifically saying another member of staff? Because I think people who have to sign here, they must have an authority. But now if you just say another member of staff, it gives me a problem.
Honorable Chairperson, the authority ICASA is governed by the Public Financial Management Act. The Financial Management Act requires organs of state institutions to appoint a chief financial officer to assist the accounting officer to perform his or her functions. In the wording that we have here, Chairperson, which already existed in the bill, in the Act, we understand that at some point the CFO may not necessarily be in office. This has happened at ICASA for a number of years, in fact. And it's to cater for such circumstances, because the CFO, once appointed, Honorable Jacob, his or her functions are defined in the Public Financial Management Act. So there's no confusion there. But in circumstances where there's a gap, the council may designate such a person. And I think this is what this section is trying to say. It says the accounting officer, because the accounting officer, even when the CFO is in office, the accounting officer is actually the officer in charge of financial accountability. So I think the legislator had an intention that this particular function can also be designated for accounting purposes. And we then included there, or a counselor, because the counselor can also be perform an executive function. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, going to die on this one. I'll let it go. But I'm still not happy about that. Another member of staff.
The honourable member will not give up, even if we say the instead of designated. I know Mr. Peter used the word designated, even if we use delegated, because in the government, as in any other entity, there's a delegation of powers, and people exercise their function in terms of delegation, which of course at the end of the day doesn't divest the accounting officer of that responsibility. But there are instances where powers are delegated. You know, it's the same thing like it does. For instance, where a person, for instance, you will delegate a person or the CEO, for instance, for that matter, might delegate another member, which is the senior manager of staff, you know, functions, you know, and all those functions go with, for instance, the signing of checks, or it got financial implications. So it will mean now he cannot exercise the delegation that he has been given. So it's the same thing that we know even from even everywhere. People have got a certain financial responsibility. For instance, in my organization, I might sign checks up to 5,000. A senior official might sign up to a certain amount, and then the amounts go up and up and up. But it's in an area of responsibility. So that issue now is, I think that section is taking that into account. The same with the council. I have, for instance, the chairperson might have a certain amount where he can sign, and then other councillors, he can designate and delegate to other councillors to do the same. It's everywhere. It's a day-to-day phenomenon, for that matter. But I'm not.
It's a debate.
The more he speaks, the more he complicates this issue. I think we better leave it as it is.
You must underline another member of staff. Another member of staff. I think that's the argument. So you can also take it as a homework and go and slip over it, and next week when we finalize, before we finalize, then you explain so that we are satisfied. Okay, Master.
Honorable Joseph, in relation to page 12, related to the file, the most important thing to note, Honorable, is that over the years, the first point is that this file says you see them, they were passed around 2000. And it's now 2013. The argument that we were putting forward is that the value of money has gone up. And the other issue was that we looked at similar legislation, for example, the interception law, to say what are the fines that are current and are going to ensure that when we put up the fine, people do not like budget for it. In their say, we will go against this one, we don't mind paying a fine. It was a very serious discussion that we had with the industry. They had their view to say, if you check at this, it might be too steep or whatever. But the point that was acknowledged by one, that you don't have to pay 5 million if you do not disobey the rules. So we are trying to discourage people from disobeying the regulations and the rules. No one has to pay. This is just 5 million that is there. And we might find that in the next 10 years, people don't pay if they do not go against the rules. But the point was that in terms of our assessment with similar legislations or whatever, this
fines are going to act as a deterrent, but they are reasonable, and they acknowledge that in terms of policy making, we have the right to determine the fines in line with this law. We are not encroaching in the Minister of Finance or any other legislature making body territory. So when you make the law, in terms of dealing with deterrence and allocating the fines for anyone that does not follow the law, this will be within limits. But they agreed that they will not pay if they follow the law correctly or follow the regulations as outlined by ICAS.
Chairperson, also the question was whether are we not encroaching on the jurisdiction of the courts. this drafting, Chairperson, was accepted by the Department of Justice. There were drafting which we were corrected on by that department, but these particular ones were actually accepted in the drafting that they exist. And when the courts make judgments, they would interpret that their imposition of judgments and fines may take into account the fact that the drafting is saying not exceeding a certain term for this kind of infringements that are here. So there has been that consultation with the department, and I don't know if my legal colleagues want to take it further.
Thank you, Mr. Peter. I hope I don't complicate the issue further. setting out a maximum penalties is what is constitutionally allowed. What is not allowed, Chairperson, is setting up minimum penalties or sentences. Then when you do that, then it's interpreted as if you are interfering with the jurisdiction of the court, because now you are telling them what minimum they can set. This is the debate, if members will recall, that has taken place when the protection of state information was being debated, because it set up minimum as well as maximum sentences. At the end of the day, Parliament had to deal away with minimum sentences, because when you do that, it's interpreted as if you are interfering with the jurisdiction of the court. There is nothing wrong with setting up a maximum penalty. As Mr. Mashilo has said, that the value of money is depreciated, and they needed to raise the minimum, the maximum sentences to take into account that. But as I've said, that it's only when you set up minimum sentences where it is interpreted as if you are interfering with the jurisdiction of the court. With maximum sentences, it's constitutionally compliant. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, I want to check on this. Let's say what date is it? The 28th today.
Yeah.
29. Let's say somewhere in October, the 29th of October, the inflation is 100%. So it means this 5,000 it would have devalued. It means now we have to come back to Parliament to change this so that it should be market related. I'm raising this issue because it was 250 at that time, and now we are raising this because its value has gone down. So we are making it to 1 million. That's why I'm raising this, to say, let's say somewhere in October inflation rounds to 100%. So it means we have to come back again and check on this one and say we can raise it again to 20 million.
me, for instance, I'll have said that the consultation and things that may have been taken into account is this. When the Act made was first published, 2015 may have been such a big amount of money. But now, given the evolution of the industry, it's easy for, it might be easy, let me say this, it might be easy for players to transgress or to contravene the law. Taking into account for them, that amount of money is a cent, it's a pity, so they can just pay it. It is like that. As even now, as it stands, as I've said before, it's just a maximum penalty. The court can come even to a lesser than that 200,000 that we now change it as a minimum sentence, can go even down than that. It's just that it cannot go beyond the 5 million, but it can go down even to less than the amount that now we are amending, even to less than the 200,000 for that matter, because there is no minimum amount that is set. It's only the maximum penalty that is set in the legislation. Is that taking into account that the value of money has gone up?
I'm not disputing your fact, what you are saying. But what I'm saying is that if we have to change within a short space of time, we have to come back and change this 5 million to 20 million. That's my argument. I'm not disputing to say you can vary from 1 million to 20,000 or 500 and so on. That is the argument that I have.
Chairperson, yes, that's precisely the case. I mean, we are in fact, a penalty clause deals with a person's right to freedom, and it's very important that the amounts, the limits of the penalty be set. And if an act says 50,000 and there might be 100% inflation rate, that's precisely the case. This bill will have to come back. Not will have to be come back, but the department may consider to amend the, to request amendment of the act.
They're saying that maybe by 29th of October, that was an example, you know. And then you come here, and then we amend. You come back to Parliament, not to the National Assembly, but to Parliament.
No, Chairperson, the argument is actually correct, like Mr. Smith is saying, and Honorable Jacob is correct, because at the observation of such an economic situation, certainly the legislature and this House as well will have to come and make the changes. So we agree with his contention there, but I do not see how his argument proposes to make any changes to the, because the submissions which we have received were saying that actually our amendments seem to have been too steep, and we think they are reasonable. So we may be directed on the thinking of the Honourable Member how he thinks we can deal with the section. We are amenable to that.
Yeah, I don't know, because sometimes when acts are made, instead to try to avoid, I just want to check with them, to try to avoid to come into Parliament, they put that under police. I don't know anything that could be done to avoid to come from time and again coming to Parliament. It could be put under police. Maybe you can fill me up on that one.
Thank you, Chair. There's a reason it's done in this way. I mean, one would look at, in your mind, what's the alternative? Okay, leave it to policy, leave it to a minister or someone else, where in the law you enable someone else to then change those amounts as the circumstances change in future. But that wouldn't be good for our society, because Yeah, we're not dealing with just a simple transgression of a minor administrative issue. We're dealing with criminal offences. And as Gutsmat said, we're dealing with a threat to civil liberty, to your freedom. And those are so serious in nature that it shouldn't be delegated to anyone else. It should be carefully considered by Parliament only. And as circumstances in future change, be reconsidered by Parliament and changed accordingly. But because it's such a serious matter, it shouldn't be lightly delegated to anyone else. Thank you.
Chairperson, yes, the Honourable Mr. Jacobs got a valid point in the sense that in theory it might happen that department must come back every year to have it adjusted. There is an act called the Adjustment of Fines Act, which says that whenever an Act of Parliament prescribes a maximum imprisonment, the equivalent in amount will be as determined by the Minister of Justice. The Minister of Justice is then empowered to make regulations to prescribe that amount, which compares with 1 year equals this amount. And if I'm talking on the correction, but as I have it at the moment, it says 1 year equals 20,000, 2 years is 40,000. And that's much less than is proposed in the bill. So I would agree with the department. Okay, firstly, yes, one can write a law that it's not necessary to come back every year. That Adjustment of Fines Act makes provision. But that act's prescribed penalties is less than this proposed in the bill. So I would agree with the department that these be kept, at least, well, it would be at least be valid for a year or two, three, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honorable Jacobs, remember it was in 2000 that the first ICASA Act was passed. That's why we are talking about the bill. But I think the proposal made by my colleagues from the state law advisor to say it is a maximum and the court will decide how much when it adjudicates. But what the department usually does when it makes the law is that will not come back to you now and then to change the law. Hence this part of saying the maximum will be $5 million, and then over time we assess the law that we have drafted and check in terms of the offences if it becomes a problem or whatever. We might come back to you to say we have discovered that even when we said $5 million, it's a lot, it's too little because people continuously go against the law and they pay and it's fine. So I think the intention here, as they usually say, the spirit of this section was to ensure that we stick with that maximum of $5 million, and once we discover that there's a problem, then I think that's when we come to correct the problem. But if it's an inflation problem that we cannot control or something like that, I don't think that the department will just come to so that you are there just to make the laws. But we will have to find that it's a problematic matter that needs your addressing, and we will be very careful when we come to you and measure to say whether it's necessary to put you through unnecessary amendments. But in terms of policy and legislation, as the Honourable Member, usually in terms of practice from the regulatory side, you find that it's more effective when it's in this kind of law. When it becomes a policy or whatever, the interpretation out there becomes totally different. They say that this is what the intention or whatever, and people are always reluctant to comply like it is as it's part of this law. So I would say rather than make it via policy, it's very important that we keep it as part of legislation because it also assists ICASA to implement this without what it only does is say this is what the law says and then this is what we are going to charge you. It allows them to implement this law efficiently as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Masjid. Are we done, Mr. Masjid? Do you still have? Okay, DGT, do you want to say something?
No, Chairperson, it seems to us that there's just that one matter that we had to go and look at, which pertains to the quorum issue, wherein Honorable Jacobs contended that it may not be clear for the member of the public. Yes, and the issue of checks in Section 15(4) of the ICASA Act. We'll work with our colleagues to look at these two matters, and we'll come back to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On that note, let me thank the department, the state law advisors, the guests, and the honorable members, and say we will meet next week when we finalize, if we are satisfied. But hopefully we will finalize next week. Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.
Can I get that document? The electronic communication document.
The presentation.
Yeah.